Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. And today's episode, Blackbeard's True Story, Unraveling the Myth. And what a myth. Over 300 years have passed since the notorious pirate Blackbeard exploded onto the front pages of history. And dozens, if not hundreds, of writers and historians have been repeating stories of Blackbeard which, although entertaining, are largely false. Most of us have come to believe that his name was Teach and that he was born in England. And he was a bloodthirsty murderer, was he not? And he buried treasure from Florida to New Hampshire, did he not? You might recall an episode we did on Blackbeard back in 2016, which I opened up with a retelling of author Kevin Duffus's search for Blackbeard's mythical sister Susanna's gravestone in Bath, North Carolina, in his book The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. Kevin Duffus is a leading authority on Blackbeard and all things concerning Blackbeard, having uncovered a treasure trove of documentation regarding the life, death, actions, finding of court records, and deeds of Blackbeard and his crew. And the real story differs quite a bit from what most people have been told. You're in for some real eye-opening discussion as we begin to unravel the myth that has grown up around the pirate Blackbeard and his crew. Kevin Duffus, it's great to have you with us today. I'm hoping you can share some of your background and the reason you've spent decades uncovering the real story of Blackbeard.
Thank you, John. I'm extremely excited to have been invited to participate in your podcast, 1001 Heroes, and I am also thrilled to be able to spend time with you, someone who I know shares my passion in history and also in the pirate Blackbeard. One of the great advantages that I have over the many other writers and authors and historians who have written about Blackbeard is that I have a very close knowledge of the very places where Blackbeard spent his last couple of years. I'm very familiar with the waters of the Pamlico River and Pamlico Sound and Ocracoke, and I've even sailed in Blackbeard's wake, so to speak, in the Windward Islands, not far from where he captured the ship that became the Queen Anne's Revenge, all the way through the Virgin Islands. And I have an intimate knowledge of maritime practices and also Blackbeard's haunts, if you will, in the towns of Bath and Ocracoke Island. So that gives me a bit of an advantage. Many of the other authors who've written about Blackbeard simply repeat what other historians and authors have written over the last 300 years about the pirate. I am very particular about going back to the primary sources, the original documents, and trying to get as close to the story as possible. Now, as far as my background goes, I was an Air Force brat. I was the son of a D-Day pilot who, after World War II, joined the Air Force. And like all Air Force families, we moved all over the country and the world every year or 2 years. And my father's last assignment was to be commander of the ROTC detachment at East Carolina University, which landed us in Greenville in eastern North Carolina in the late 1960s. And when we arrived there, I had just not too long before, the year before, had seen the very popular Disney movie Blackbeard's Ghost, starring Peter Ustinov and Dean Jones and Suzanne Pleshette. And that was my first introduction to the pirate known as Blackbeard. Until that movie came along, I had not heard of him. So when we moved to Greenville and I started spending a little bit of time in the county library there, I found a couple of books about pirates in eastern North Carolina. One book in particular was a history of the county that had been published back in 1911. And the second chapter of that book was devoted to Blackbeard the Pirate. And the author of that book described the times that Blackbeard would, in between his piratical cruises, would supposedly sail up the river to visit his sister, who lived on the banks of the river called the Tar River, which today is that area is about halfway between the town of Greenville and the town of Washington on the Pamlico River. And according to the author of the book, his sister's name was Susanna. And he even said that not long before this book was published, that Susanna's grave was still visible, the headstone was, and that treasure seekers had from time to time visited her grave and had dug holes digging for Blackbeard's treasure, as if he would have buried his treasure next to the grave of his sister. But so this was one of the little things that really captured my imagination as a teenager. I also had read that Blackbeard's last battle occurred off the island of Ocracoke. So I looked at a map and saw that Ocracoke was not too terribly far from Greenville. And I asked my dad if I could borrow the keys to the family car so I could drive out there. I wanted to visit the place where Blackbeard was killed. And of course, he didn't think I had enough experience behind the wheel to drive that far. And so he said, no, I can't let you do that. And I eventually convinced him to let me ride my bicycle out there. It was a one-day trip in a one-day trip in a car, and it was a three-day trip on a bicycle. And but he, that's how determined I was to visit this place where Blackbeard once walked. And I had to recruit two unwitting high school friends to go with me on their bicycles. And but we, that's what we did. We rode to Ocracoke Island, and I'll never forget, we rode into the little village there. This is now 1971, and so it was a lot less developed than it is now, but we rode up to the community store there on the harbor, and there were three elderly gentlemen sitting in rocking chairs, and I went up and said, now, I had just arrived here on my bicycle after 3 days of riding, and I had seen the movie Blackbeard's Ghost, and I knew that Blackbeard in the movie had built a hotel on this rocky cliff 100 feet above the bay where his last battle took place. And I asked them if they'd tell me where I could find that 100-foot-high rocky cliff, and they both smiled and then just busted out laughing. And then one of them, with his high-tide Ocracoke brogue, said, son, you come to the wrong place. He said, the highest place on this island is only about 8 feet. And so that was my introduction, my tutorial on the fact that you shouldn't try to learn history by watching Hollywood movies. And so
it's a good example. For the sake of our listeners, Ocracoke is a tiny island south of Hatteras on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and it's an escape for a lot of people from inland, from cities like Roanoke, and then northward cities like Virginia Beach. And we in Virginia Beach escape to the Outer Banks and Ocracoke when we're trying to get away from our tourist season up here. So, but Ocracoke every year invites Kevin to lecture at their Blackbeard Festival. So he's become quite a hit down there. Is that right?
Well, that's true. And that actually that festival has been going on now for, I think, 13, 14 years. And it is because of me, because I was instrumental in getting that started. In 2007, I was there on the very anniversary, on November 22nd, which would be the anniversary of the Battle of Ocracoke, and I was there taking photographs for my book, which I was still working on and writing, which was not published until the following year. And it occurred to me that Ocracoke holds an annual memorial service for four British sailors who died in World War II. And I thought, well, why shouldn't we have a memorial service for the pirates and the Royal Navy sailors who perished in that very famous battle? So the following year, I recruited 60 pirate reenactors from a group called Blackbeard's Crew, which is based there in the Tidewater, Virginia area. And we went down and held a very solemn memorial service. And that has since grown into a multi-day pirate festival, which always concludes with the memorial service. But I want to get back to Susanna, Blackbeard's mythical sister, because after riding my bicycle out there and getting a taste of Blackbeard history out there, I decided I wanted to find his sister's grave, and after a great effort, and I had to do a little bit of research to figure out where located where along the Tar River that might have been, and it was hidden in a very wooded area that was thick with briars, and there were biting flies buzzing around my head, but I eventually found her grave, or her sandstone headstone, which even to this day has survived.
Wow.
And as I looked at the inscription on the headstone, I sort of had the same kind of sinking feeling I had when I realized that there wasn't a 100-foot high cliff at Ocracoke. I noticed that she was born 37 years after Blackbeard was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized that this couldn't, even though the name was correct, and this was the very headstone that was mentioned in that book in 1911, I realized that this woman could not have possibly have been his sister.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, and in the book, I describe how in searching for her grave, I tripped and fell and had inadvertently stepped in this hole that went down into the ground, and I was able to make the hole a little bit larger so I could stick a flashlight down. I could see a floor, and eventually I was able to put my head down in there, and I had stuck my head in someone else's grave. It was a crypt that one end corner had caved in, and so I knew then that I was in the middle of a much larger cemetery. There were probably at least 18 other graves that did not have headstones, but the point to remember is that at that moment, and ever since, for almost 40 years, I had felt like I was either haunted by whoever that was whose grave I stuck my head in,
mm-hmm.
or that I had somehow taken on a responsibility or a debt of, or an obligation of some sort. I could never forget that moment, and I could never stop wondering both whose grave that was, but also who was Susanna White, and why did this author in 1911 think that she was somehow related to Blackbeard? And I'm happy to say that after years of research and many, many visits to archives and courthouses, in the middle of writing the book, I was able to discover and prove the identity of Susanna White. And indeed, she did have a very distant connection to the pirate Blackbeard. Not that she was his sister, and she was not even related to him, but she was, in fact, the granddaughter of one of his crew members. So that's another story hopefully we'll get to. But that's kind of the background of how I got into this. Many years later, I became an avid sailor, and I had a sailboat that I kept docked in the little village of Bath, which was Blackbeard's sort of headquarters in his last couple of years.
Explain for a moment why Bath was so important back in that time, in the early 1700s.
Well, The continent of North Carolina, which at one time was united with South Carolina, it was simply called Carolina, and so this was the northern colony. Most of the early population of North Carolina actually came from Virginia, and they came by land. They came across the border and began to settle along the Albemarle Sound, and then eventually settlers began to work their way up the Pamlico River. One reason for that is that the inlet that cut through the Outer Banks and provided access to the ocean from the Albemarle Sound, this was Roanoke Inlet, and this is a very famous inlet because it dated back to the Walter Raleigh expeditions, but it began to shoal up, become too shallow for major or large trading vessels. Only the shallowest draft vessels were able to get through Roanoke Inlet. So the next deep water inlet was Ocracoke Inlet, and it just so happened that vessels coming in there could very easily go up the Pamlico River. And so it happened that the town of Bath was settled in the late 1690s. It actually was incorporated as a town in 1705, and by 1715 it was became the principal port of entry for the colony of North Carolina.
Which is incredible. So, North Carolina needed ocean commerce and trade, and that was the key.
Well, it was. And, you know, so North Carolina, of course, has long been said to be the valley of humility between two mountains of conceit, which are Virginia and South Carolina. But so you have to picture Virginia, the development of Virginia and South Carolina during this time, the late six, you know, Charleston was settled around 1673. And of course, Virginia much earlier with Jamestown.
Both due to great ports, easy access, right?
Yes, deep water ports, easy access, and in between them, of course, you have North Carolina, which is the inland waters of North Carolina are defended by the chain of barrier islands known as the Outer Banks, and there are at the time there were numerous inlets that breached the Outer Banks. But they were constantly shifting and shoaling, and it made the development of North Carolina difficult. But so Bath was selected by 1715 to become the capital of North Carolina. It was made a principal port of entry, and the various governors who had administered North Carolina prior to 1716 all lived up on the Albemarle Sound. And so in 1716, the Lords Proprietors Governor, who was Charles Eden, relocated down to the town of Bath. He established himself on a 400-acre plantation on the west bank of Bath Creek. Also, just to give your listeners a kind of a perspective, a geographic perspective, Bath is about 52 miles in a straight line from Ocracoke Inlet. And it roughly compares, I think the distance may be a little bit less, but from the English Channel up to London. So it was not that unusual to have a port city or town or, you know, capital that far from the ocean. And it did provide some defensive opportunities as well. But anyway, so Bath was this burgeoning little town, and that certainly played a part in the story of Blackbeard and his pirate crew.
Yeah, there's a method to our madness here, listeners. The reason we're trying to outline why Bath was so important is that we're going to find out that many of Blackbeard's closest crew was from Bath. These guys took to the water to make a living, and things were pretty tough in Bath during the days of piracy. And it wasn't unusual for these guys to seek income any way they could find it. Would that be a fair thing to say?
Well, absolutely. As you've already alluded to the fact that his real history is quite different. I would say that his heritage and his motivations to become a pirate, his actual treasure that he maybe brought into North Carolina, and even his demise, the Battle at Ocracoke, all of those things were very different than what the public has been led to believe. And I actually believe that probably one of the most significant factors in trying to discover Blackbeard's true origins and his true identity, which I actually believe is the ultimate Blackbeard treasure, which is yet to have been solved even by me. But one of the most important clues is that the majority of his most trusted shipmates who had been arrested in North Carolina and taken to Virginia for trial were the sons, and in a few instances the slaves of Bath and Pamlico River plantation owners.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered, which is also very controversial but important, is that the majority of those men were not executed, contrary to what so many other historians have claimed.
We'll return to our interview with Kevin Duffus and today's story, Blackbeard, the man behind the myth, right after these sponsor messages.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And now back to our interview. I'd like to start with what's in a name, and let's drop a bomb on Teach.
Right. Well, yes, most people, they say, if you say, you know, you mentioned Blackbeard, they go, oh, you mean Edward Teach. And the fact is that if you're a researcher and you start going through all of the original source, primary source documents, I mean, I've went to the British Archives in London and spent days and days there handling all of these original letters, and something like 98% of the time anyone actually spelled his name, it was spelled as T-H-A-T-C-H.
And we would have Thatch.
We would pronounce it today as Thatch, but that's not how they pronounced that word in 1718.
Right.
And the fact is, there's the possibility that even Thatch was an alias.
Well, you researched the name Teach Thatch in London, did you not? And tried to find anything linking Blackbeard to the name Teach. And if I'm right, you couldn't find anything. Is that correct?
Well, not in London, but in Bristol, England. And
okay.
Of course, the longstanding belief has been that Blackbeard was a native of Bristol, England.
Right.
And so. There was a family from the Gloucester, England area, which is kind of north of Bristol, whose last name was T-H-A-C-H-E. And, you know, it gets rather complicated, though, because, I did spend some time in Bristol and could find no credible, verifiable evidence whatsoever that Blackbeard was from Bristol. Now, I did spend a day with a pirate tour guide who wanted to show me the house that Blackbeard grew up in when he was a young boy, and the tunnels that he used to sneak through. But I kept asking him, well, can you show me, you know, written evidence, primary source evidence that would confirm the stories you're telling me? And of course, there was none. So I believe that it's possible to deduce Blackbeard's origins and identity not by using names and genealogy, but by examining very closely his behaviors and his travels.
You can expand on that now. I think that's hugely important. I think that's going to bring us to a common conclusion. You know, that why would a guy from Bristol suddenly appear on the coast of North Carolina, make himself extremely friendly with a lot of guys who would eventually become his crewmen, and all of a sudden develop strong ties with not only the governor, but his tax collector, Tobias Knight. And all this happening from a guy who had no knowledge, basically, of the North Carolina coast. I think it defies common sense.
Well, and it's also contrary to the rules of human nature. I mean, it's, and of all the history that I've ever studied, I mean, the one common denominator among all of the various civilizations on Earth going back 7,000 years, the one thing that connects all of us is human nature and behavior. And yes, I mean, that's exactly the point I'm trying to make, is that ultimately, in Blackbeard's final battle, when it was a life or death event, he was surrounded by men from Bath, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
They were his closest friends, his most trusted allies, and it is just absolutely beyond reason, and again contrary to the rules of human nature, that he would have been a relative stranger from Bristol, England, who would trust these men, and those men wouldn't have trusted him. And so when I say that it's possible to deduce Blackbeard's, at least his origins, if not his identity, again, I say it's based on who he surrounded himself with. But there's another way to tell this story, too, and that, you know, Blackbeard's piratical career lasted only about 23 months, but he first shows up in the official records in December of 1716, and then, of course, he's killed in November of 1718. Here we have this pirate, and by the way, in December of 1716, he's identified as the captain of his own ship. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support the long-standing belief that Blackbeard was a subordinate of the pirate captain Benjamin Hornigold. And I have been at odds with two other pirate historians who I won't name, but are fairly well known, who both swear that Blackbeard had been, you know, a student of Benjamin Hornigold and was never raised to any high command or whatever. Well, the fact is that the very first time he shows up in any record whatsoever, he's already the captain of his own ship. And it just so happens that on that ship are many of these young men from Bath, yep, including black men as well, who were slaves, but at the same time, one in particular was his very close friend and trusted comrade, Caesar.
Yes.
But I'm going to jump forward now to December of 1717. In fact, the date was Tuesday, December 5th of 1717. And just a couple of weeks before, Blackbeard had captured the French ship formerly known as Concord, which Blackbeard renamed Queen Anne's Revenge. And now he's sailing from east to west across the Leeward Islands of the Caribbean, headed kind of toward Puerto Rico, and he encounters a merchant sloop. He stops that sloop and forces the captain of the sloop over to his vessel for about 8 hours while Blackbeard's crew goes aboard, and they basically took about, I think it was 4 or 5 cows and 36 pigs or hogs to move over to the Queen Anne's Revenge so that the pirates would have something to eat. And in the course of the 8 hours that the sloop captain was with Blackbeard, he informed Blackbeard that the King of England, George I, his Privy Council had announced that they were sending out to the colonies a proclamation offering a pardon to pirates. And this was a pretty significant event in the golden age of piracy in the history of that time. And so Henry Bostock was the captain. He informed Blackbeard of what the terms of the pardon were. And the terms were that pirates had to cease committing acts of piracy in just a few weeks. In fact, in exactly 1 month. By January 5th of 1718, Blackbeard and all the other pirates in the Caribbean were supposed to cease committing acts of piracy. And then they had until September 5th of that year to surrender themselves to a royal official, either a governor or a Royal Navy officer, captain. And so the reason why I'm telling you this is, so Blackbeard has got, he's got 400 men aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge. They consume an enormous amount of food every day, 3 meals a day. They're burning through their provisions.
That's a huge ship, like Queen Anne's. I didn't realize it was that big, 400.
Well, 400 men. Well, they were packed in there pretty tight, and I mean, probably the sleeping conditions weren't particularly comfortable on there. But the ship itself was about a little bit less than 100 feet long.
It was a slave ship, wasn't it?
It was. It was a slave ship. Now, according to the terms of the king's pardon, Blackbeard should have surrendered to the nearest colonial official. So he had a choice of either turning around and sailing back to Antigua to the east, or sailing west to Jamaica, where there was a royal governor. And he could have gone in and surrendered to Jamaica, you know, not had any concern about, you know, being hunted down or killed. The only problem with that is that he didn't own the Queen Anne's Revenge. He didn't have papers indicating that he was the master or owner of the Queen Anne's Revenge. So the first thing would have happened in Jamaica is that they would have taken that ship from him. Mm-hmm. They said, you know, they'd say, well, this doesn't belong to you. This, you know, so you've got to come ashore. And then once he's ashore, he could have been classified as a vagrant seaman and then immediately forced aboard one of the king's warships not as an officer, but as the lowest man and stuck in the forecastle and just simply been, you know, a common sailor. Well, that would have been quite a change of scenery for the captain of the Queen Anne's Revenge. Also, Blackbeard and his inner circle of friends from Bath were then at that time in the possession of 60 slaves. And so they would have also in Jamaica or anywhere else would have lost those slaves. So instead of following the terms of the king's pardon, Blackbeard and his crew continue to sail and pirate after January 5th. They have to continue pirating after January 5th because they have to keep everybody fed. But their point was to return to North Carolina. In the process, they sailed past four colonial governors, any one of whom they could have surrendered to. But instead, they took a great risk by sailing all the way to North Carolina, where he wrecked the Queen Anne's Revenge at the inlet that we now know is Beaufort Inlet. And then in a smaller vessel, a sloop, he then sails to Bath with those 60 slaves and only 40 white crew members, many of whom, again, who have fathers who own plantations along the Bath Creek area in the Pamlico. So that's one of my examples of why it's reasonable to dismiss the possibility that Blackbeard was from Bristol, England, or even Jamaica for that matter, because there's been a theory that's been floated about that has no basis in fact whatsoever, that Blackbeard had been actually an Edward Thatch of Jamaica who owned a plantation and had a family there and was an upstanding citizen of Jamaica. I asked the historian who came up with this theory, well, if that's true, why didn't Blackbeard ever sail to Jamaica? He never once set foot on Jamaica the entire time that we know of him as a pirate. And so I kind of dismissed that possibility. So there's lots of evidence that tie the man who was Blackbeard to the Bath area.
I'm going to return just for a moment back to the theory that's out there, the myth that's out there, that he served under Hornigold, and that's how he came up in the pirating business. That doesn't explain for how he was first known to be the master of his own ship and had his own crew, again, the guys from Bath, okay, the boys. If he had served under Hornigold, he wouldn't have come up with the Bath boys. He would have been assigned a crew from a captured ship, most likely. That wasn't the course that Blackbeard's history follows. So it doesn't make any sense that he came up under Hornigold. The next thing I wanted to ask you about was, where did he set foot? You know, the myth out there is that he set foot in just about every place between New Hampshire and Florida. Where did his travels actually take him? How far north did he go? And how far south into the Caribbean did he go?
Well, it's a great question. And actually, I address that in my book by publishing a fairly large map of colonial America and the Caribbean that kind of traces his various piratical cruises. Of course, I published that book in 2008, and since then I've kind of refined my knowledge of his travels. So there may be some information in there that's not exactly correct. But I can say with absolute confidence that he never sailed during the 2 years that he was a pirate. Never sailed any farther north than the Delaware Bay. He actually went up the Delaware River to Philadelphia, and there's really no question that that is something that happened. He had made a couple of trips to Philadelphia or the Delaware area during his 2 years as a pirate, but and actually records, I've seen two documents that suggest that he either was a mate on a ship that sailed out of Philadelphia, or a mate, this was prior to being a pirate, or a mate on a ship that sailed to Philadelphia. Supposedly the people of Philadelphia knew him well, but I actually think in the summer of 1718, the reason why he went to Philadelphia was actually to seek medical advice for a malady that he had that was called the French disease back then.
I think we can safely say syphilis to our listeners here.
Sure. Yeah. If you prefer that to the French disease, that's fine. And by the way, the French called it the Italian disease, but that's a whole nother. But But so, you know, a number of years ago, the History Channel had a documentary about how Blackbeard supposedly buried his treasure on the Isle of Shoals off the coast of New Hampshire. And they devoted an entire hour to this program and even went out to the Isle of Shoals looking for his treasure. I'm really fascinated by all the different treasure stories and also houses. Blackbeard, if you believe everything you read, Blackbeard had houses all up and down the East Coast and even one back in London. But I don't know that we know Blackbeard sailed as far south and east as just north of Barbados, which is between Barbados and Martinique, which is where he captured the French slaver Concord. He may or may not have gone as far south as Panama, but the records really don't support that whatsoever. I don't think he probably got any farther south along the Central American coast than Honduras. And again, it surprises people when I tell them that, you know, his piratical career lasted 23 months. That's quite a shock. And by the way, he also was only known as Blackbeard by his nom de guerre, which is a French war name. He was only known as Blackbeard for 13 months. The very first document that we've found that states his alias was one of these Philadelphia letters from October of 1717. It was just a month before he captured the ship that became the Queen Anne's Revenge, but that described him as Edward Thatch, alias Blackbeard. And by the way, in 1718, anytime he was referred to as Blackbeard, and even by historians for another 100 years, Blackbeard was always spelled as two distinct words, Black Beard.
Kevin, I'd like to hear your theory of how the name Blackbeard became associated with the man whose real name is very possibly Edward Beard. Can you tell us that story? Is that a fair way to present it?
That is a fair way to present it. I mean, and that's maybe the most controversial aspect of my research and the conclusions that I draw in my book. And I'll have to say that I was not the first person to present the theory or the possibility that Blackbeard or Edward Thatch was in fact, or possibly Edward Beard. There were three very respected and accomplished genealogists who spent a lot of time studying the deeds and records of what is now Beaufort County. Back in 1718, it was called Bath County. But they found and were quite startled by discovering that one of the more prominent residents of Bath, dating between 1706 and 1711, was a mariner or sea captain whose name was Captain James Beard, B-E-A-R-D. This gentleman was owned a sloop called the James, and he does show up in the records of both Charleston and New York as having called on those ports. Captain James Beard actually died in Charleston, almost certainly of yellow fever, in 1711. And we know that he had a son. Unfortunately, the records don't tell us what his son's name was. Now, when James Beard died in Charleston, he got sick and died so suddenly that he only had time to record a non-cupative will, which was an oral testimony on his deathbed. And that was recorded into the records of South Carolina. And he said that he was bequeathing his earthly possessions to his wife and his son. But unfortunately, he didn't name his son. And I'm still searching for any sort of documentation that will prove or disprove that his son was, in fact, named Edward.
Did you find that he owned property around Bath?
Yes. James Beard owned a 400-acre plantation adjacent to Governor Eden's 400-acre plantation, and which was also on the south side adjacent to customs collector Tobias Knight's plantation. So you have three plantations in a row owned by two men that are known to have had a very close relationship with the pirate who became known as Blackbeard, and this merchant captain named James Beard, who had a son whose name we don't know. James Beard also had a daughter whose name happened to be Susanna, And Susanna married a man who owned a property. Well, actually, Susanna inherited her father's 600 acres on the next river south of the Pamlico River, which is known as the Noose River. And there is a creek. It's now today a little southeast of New Bern, but there's a creek there called Beard's Creek. And Susanna married a man named Frank, last name Frank. So she became known as Susanna Beard Frank. And one of the more intriguing clues that I came across is that probably one of the most respected and esteemed historians of North Carolina, who taught at the University of North Carolina for many years, was a man named William Powell, or Bill Powell. And he wrote a number of important books on North Carolina place names. And he actually, back in the 1960s, said that Beard's Creek was associated by the people who lived in the area with Blackbeard, not knowing that there was the possibility that this Susanna Beard, daughter of James Beard and possibly the sister of Edward Beard, you know, lived there on that creek.
It's not too far-fetched to assume that the pirate Blackbeard, knowing that he had strayed into piracy and not wanting to besmirch the family name, and feeling like possibly he was the black sheep of the family, decided to invent the name Blackbeard to distract people from his true name. Would that be at least a good guess?
Well, it's more than a guess. I think it's a reasonable hypothesis that's supported by really a significant amount of evidence. And I'll have to say that when I published my book, I was, for lack of a better way to say it, I was attacked by other historians, some of them associated with the state of North Carolina and its Department of Cultural Resources. And they said that this whole idea that Blackbeard was Edward Beard was preposterous, but they were defending, you know, their own publications. So I did a lot more research. I was curious as to were there any other people during Blackbeard's time who went by their surname preceded by a color. And sure enough, there was a man who actually lived in Scotland whose name in Gaelic was Ruaidh MacGregor, which meant Red MacGregor. And he was the son of a MacGregor. And so the sons of men, depending on the color of their hair, would often be called, you know, red or black. In this case of Red MacGregor, everybody knows the name because he was also known as Rob Roy, and he was, you know, a Scottish cattle rustler who was known by his friends and neighbors in Scotland as Red MacGregor. And actually, there's also a clue in the series Outlander, which I've referred to at times speaking to audiences, I believe Jamie MacGregor was referred to as Red Jamie or Red MacGregor as well. So it's not preposterous that Edward Beard would have become known as Blackbeard. I'm sure it was kind of a double entendre. It was kind of an inside joke that it was unusual that he grew, had a beard. Beards were not the fashion during this time, and he was probably among the 400 men aboard the Queen Anne's Revenge the only one who had a beard, and there may have been a reason why he had that beard. And by the way, there's only one first-hand account that describes Blackbeard's appearance, and it was by that same merchant captain that I had already mentioned, Henry Bostock of the sloop Margaret, that Blackbeard had detained for 8 hours on December 5th of 1717. In the deposition that Henry Bostock gave after he was released, he sailed to the island of St. Christopher's and reported to the officials there and said, "I've just been robbed by this pirate, you know, Edward Tatch." And he described this Edward Tatch as being a very tall, bare man who had a very black beard, which he wore very long. So that's the entire physical description that we have of Blackbeard. I mean, he was tall, he was skinny, and he had a long black beard. I find it rather, it's rather humorous that one of my predecessors as a historian writing a book on Blackbeard, a biography of Blackbeard, was the dean of the School of Law at Wake Forest University, who in 1974 published a book titled Blackbeard, A Reappraisal of His Life and Times. And in that book, he wrote that that Blackbeard was about 38 to 40 years old of age about the time that he was killed. And ever since, that was the very first time in history that any historian or writer ventured a guess as to how old Blackbeard was. But 38 to 40 years old. Now, first of all, that is quite a bit older than what has been determined to be the median age of pirates during the Golden Age of Piracy, which is based on official records. We know that the median age was about 26 or 27 years old. So a 38 to 40-year-old man would have been quite old to be a pirate. So I was curious, how did Robert Lee come up with this estimation of Blackbeard's age? And you have to read the end notes in his book to see what led him to believe that that number. And in the end notes, he said that he based his estimation of Blackbeard's age on pictures or images of Blackbeard that had been made a few years after his death. And the specific one he refers to is the very famous picture of the pirate Blackbeard holding a cutlass in one hand and with a brace of pistols. And everybody's seen this image. And unfortunately, though, what the author Robert Lee and all these other writers have not told their readers is that every single image ever made of the pirate Blackbeard was conceived and put to paper by artists who never laid eyes on the pirate at all. The most famous one in the book General History of Pirates was made by an artist who lived in Oxford, England, and it was, and I jokingly tell folks, he probably used his neighbor as a model for Blackbeard. Nobody knows what Blackbeard looked like, and nevertheless, and there's another image of Blackbeard that shows Blackbeard. It's, I call it the smoking ears Blackbeard. It's the one. It's kind of a headshot of Blackbeard with the burning fuses and the smoke coming up, and he has these big, wide, glaring eyes, just bulging eyeballs. And so, I find it humorous that numerous actors and reenactors and impersonators always depict Blackbeard with these big bulging eyeballs. Well, that's all based on a fictional image. It's quite funny to think about.
And this has been a lot of fun this far. I'm looking forward to part two.
Right, and I'll have to say that in part two, in particular, you refer to him as Black Caesar, but it is the black pirate named Caesar. But he really ultimately is the key to proving Blackbeard's origins and identity. So I'm really excited about being able to talk about him.
Coming next week, we'll take a deep dive into the last days of Blackbeard and his crew while continuing to unravel the myth that has grown up around Blackbeard. Here in Part 1, Kevin Duffus has built a pretty strong case on behalf of Blackbeard's real name being Beard, not Edward Teach, and that Blackbeard and most of his pirate crew were all from the area of Bath, North Carolina, not from England. I'm sure many of you were surprised to hear that Blackbeard's term of piracy was less than 2 years, and that only one physical description of him was ever given, that saying that he was tall, thin, and had a long black beard, and that was it. We'll have lots of questions for Kevin Duffus next week. Was it true that Blackbeard lit fuses in his beard to give himself a devilish appearance in order to frighten his quarry? Did Blackbeard's headless body really swim 3 laps around his boat after he was beheaded? What were his last words? Who was Israel Hands? What happened to Blackbeard's skull? Did a silversmith inscribe it? What happened to his crew? Were they all hung on Gallows Road in Williamsburg? Being a history researcher, you mentioned once that the spirit of the person whose grave you stepped in sort of guided you to find the real story. Were there other times the other side reached out to you? What are some of the legends and stories about relatives of Blackbeard or his crew or his hidden treasure are told around the Pamlico Sound and River area? These questions and many more coming in Part 2 next week Sunday night at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. We always appreciate reviews for 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. So if you have a chance, please stop and send us a review. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. Our guest today has been Kevin Duffus, author of The Last Days of Blackbeard the Pirate. Everyone, stay safe out there, and we'll be back soon.